University of Illinois. Mr. Stevens.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel, Professor Soon. My name is David Stevens, and I represent the plaintiff, Yongchen Soon, in this appeal to determine if default was improperly vacated in the district court or if summary judgment was improperly entered in the district court in this employment discrimination case. I will ask this court to reverse the judgment of the district court and to remand this cause for a new trial, or I should say for a first trial, either on damages only or, if necessary, on all issues. The district court entered default against all defendants as a discovery sanction on June 23, 2005, following progressive motions and earlier orders.
I have a question about that. Did the district court just enter an order of default, or did the district court actually go the next step and enter a default judgment?
That's somewhat ambiguous in the record, Judge. They entered a default. That is, they struck the pleadings of the defendants and defaulted all defendants and allowed the plaintiff to proceed to trial on damages only.
Well, of course, the reason I'm asking is because there's a reason why the rule, why Rule 55 has these two steps. I mean, to enter an order of default is normally the first step, and there, if there's more discretion one way or the other to set aside an order of default is something which does fall within the district court's discretion, especially when a motion comes so promptly after that kind of order has been entered.
That's correct, Your Honor. There is more discretion involved if merely the defendants have been defaulted than if an actual default judgment has been entered. I would point out that when the new attorneys for the defendants filed their motion to vacate, it was labeled motion to vacate default judgment. That doesn't necessarily mean anything.
And but what does the docket say?
I have to look at the docket, Your Honor. I don't recall.
I mean, you don't need to waste your time. I mean, well, I'll take a look at it if you want. But sure. I guess
I believe it was
whichever
a default.
Whichever way, we will certainly consider this. But my own starting point is that, in general, the district court correctly stated that it's preferable to decide things on the merits. This is not a case where somebody waited 9 months and then finally strolled into court and said, please set aside either a default or a default judgment. There was very prompt action. There was clearly something going wrong. You can see some irritation on the part of the district court, but it would be a rather extreme thing to find an abuse of discretion on these facts, it seems to me.
Your Honor, it may be extreme, but if ever there was a case that called for reversal of a district court vacating a default, this is that case.
But why is this that case when it's only 6 days later or 8 days, I'm sorry?
Because quick action to vacate the default is one of three issues that this court has established must be established in the district court in order to vacate a default.
You're assuming that there's a rigidity in these three factors that I'm not sure we've ever said is there.
Your Honor, I don't believe I'm assuming a rigidity, but what I am reading is this court's jurisprudence on vacating defaults. And it's been very clearly established that not just timely moving to vacate the default is necessary, also a party wishing to vacate a default must show that there was good reason for the default.
But that's what I mean. I mean, good cause, quick action, meritorious defense. Those
Correct.
Are the three factors. But when I say rigidity, I mean the idea that they each independently have to rise to some level as opposed to a more flexible application where even if there wasn't terrific cause to have committed the default in the first place, if there's very fast action and representations as there were here that the problems with discovery that had been going on would be corrected, they do seem to have been corrected going forward from that moment once new counsel come in. It strikes me as more of a balancing process.
Even if it's a balancing process, Your Honor, presumably this court would not have labeled three different issues if all three needn't be balanced in some fashion. In this case, if you look at what the district court said when it vacated the default, it's very interesting. It explicitly stated, defendants have not convinced this court that the entry of default judgment was not warranted in this case. When you remove the double negative, what they're saying is, there has been no good cause shown for the default. In the order of the district court vacating the default, they went through all of the arguments of the defendants, and they found each and every one of them not to be valid. And yet they went ahead and said, however, as much as this court finds all of these arguments lacking in merit, It does have an interest in having cases decided on the merits and conclude that sanctions lesser than default may be appropriate in this case.
And why isn't that? I mean, it's not like the court is giving a pass to this. A default is when it's used as a sanction, as it was here. This is not a default because people weren't showing up or, you know, other reasons like that. This case had been under active litigation. District courts are supposed to weigh which sanction is the most appropriate for the situation.
That's correct, Your Honor, and there is discretion in this, and it's a balancing issue. What I'm pointing out is simply that the district court ignored one of those three prongs. It didn't balance the other two and say
it
overcomes.
So saying that the lack of good cause itself can be addressed, should have been addressed through a lesser sanction. I mean, you see, it's very troublesome. If I realize you have your merits argument, which maybe you can come to in a minute, but if you thought that there was a meritorious defense, then this is a total windfall. I mean, you're looking for to win the case because sloppy discovery practices on the part of one set of lawyers caused this default to be entered, and even moving 8 days later isn't good enough. Somehow you've got to hang on to that judgment.
Judge, we've never claimed there wasn't fast action. Once the new attorneys were hired, they moved very quickly to vacate the default. That's simply not the issue. There is a reason why default is an option as a discovery sanction. And in this case, the defendants were put on notice time and time and time again that there could be horrendous consequences to them if they did not comply with the court's orders. They failed to do so.
What kind of warning did they have, Mr. Stevens? What you say horrendous? What did the judge say in that regard?
This was under the control of a magistrate judge, Your Honor.
A magistrate judge.
Certainly. First of all, there was an informal telephone conference at which the issue of failure to respond to written discovery was discussed, and informally, without any written order, a deadline was established. That deadline passed, and then a motion to compel was filed. Another telephone conference was held in the motion to compel. The motion to compel was granted. A specific deadline was stated, and at that point, the magistrate judge said, if you don't comply, there will be consequences.
But did he say, I'm going to dismiss the suit?
He did not say it at that point, Judge, but then a second motion for sanctions was filed. The defendants did not even respond at that point, and at that point the judge said, you have thus and such amount of time to respond. If you don't respond, serious sanctions can be possible. A third motion to compel, a
but
third motion for sanctions.
But still doesn't say, I'm going to dismiss the suit. Serious sanctions is a broad term.
The attorney's fees were always ordered here, too, weren't they?
They were each time, Judge. I believe there were about six different orders for attorney fees, and each one was based upon the amount of time spent by plaintiff's counsel.
By your side.
That's correct.
Compensate you for the time.
That's correct. What the district court had to say in entering the default, I think, is helpful in this context, Judge. The district court said, defendants were provided a clear warning regarding the consequence of failing to comply with plaintiff's request for written discovery. Defendants' belated excuses for their failure to comply do not begin to justify the lengthy delays in this case, especially in the face of direct orders from the magistrate and in the face of repeated warnings regarding the consequences of inaction. This court further concludes that the belated excuses certainly do not justify the fact that even now, defendants still have not fully complied.
How long had the case been pending in the district court as of the entry of the default?
About a year and a half, Judge. Written discovery had been propounded the previous summer. The first informal telephone conference was in January. Then there was a motion to compel, which was granted, a motion for sanctions, which was granted, a second motion for sanctions, which was granted.
So kind of about 6 months of this discovery, sanctions.
That's correct. And the magistrate,
in that period?
I'm sorry, Judge.
Did you receive any discovery during that period?
There was trickling dribs and drabs coming in. We'd received partial responses, both to interrogatories and requests to produce. But no one of the six individual defendants and the seventh institutional defendant, no one defendant had completed all of the written discovery at that point.
Your opponents suggest quite a bit had been. I mean, they're telling us about Bates numbers, so
there were thousands of pages that had been disclosed at that point, Judge.
Okay.
But for any individual defendant, not all of the written discovery, either answers to interrogatories or reproduction of documents, had been completed.
Mr. Stevens, with the arsenal that a trial judge has by way of sanctions, why wasn't it considered abusive? Why shouldn't we consider it an abuse of discretion to enter the default, not even get to the vacation issue.
I think if you look at the order of the district court, where he says that, accordingly, this court must agree with the magistrate and the plaintiff that less drastic sanctions have failed, and the only proper course in this case is to impose the sanctions recommended by the magistrate, which was the striking of the pleadings and the entry of default. The magistrate was very careful with the defendants. He first gave them an informal order. He then made a written order. He told them explicitly, and the orders, of course, are in the record, that if you do not comply, more serious sanctions are possible. They were warned in the third motion for sanctions filed by the plaintiff, in which I asked for default, that the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure specifically provide for default under these circumstances. They still did not comply. They did not even respond at that point.
Are you getting no discovery during this period, or are you getting less than you feel you're entitled to?
During this particular period, I was getting no discovery. I'd received a certain amount of discovery. During this period, I received none. And then afterwards, I received a great deal. Since new counsel has been hired in the case, we received all discovery to which we were entitled.
All right. Well, perhaps you should move on to...
Yeah, well, I would agree with that, Judge.
Focus on the merits just for a minute, because cutting through everything, it really looks to me as though things start going in the wrong direction when Professor Sun doesn't choose... Professor Weaver for this teaching award, and Weaver is put out of sorts about this and starts taking negative actions. But if that's the case, there's nothing in the anti-discrimination laws that prohibits petty behavior. I mean, that's not race discrimination or anything else. It's just petty behavior. So I don't see how you have a race discrimination issue.
We have two separate issues that we were proceeding on. The first is the race discrimination issue, and Professor Weaver as the department head and his what we claim was retaliation on the Teacher of the Year Award is not part of that claim. That arises from essentially Professor Green and his comment.
Right. No, I know Professor Green makes this unfortunate comment, but then at that point, there's so much process that goes on at the university afterwards. It seems to me Professor Green gets lost in the dust eventually, you know, that there are, to put it more formally, that there is a sufficient break in the chain of causation between whatever problems Professor Green might have had with Chinese graduate students and the ultimate outcome of this tenure vote. That I don't see how you can carry Professor Green forward all the way here.
Judge, one of the witnesses in deposition in this case, who was the head of the College of Engineering Grievance Committee and also served in the College of Engineering Promotion and Tenure Committee, testified in his deposition that once a department has made a negative decision, it is virtually impossible, and those were his words, for that negative decision to be reversed at higher levels.
But that's just one person's opinion. The University of Illinois does have many opportunities for people to challenge these things, and you're actually asking us to say that everything from the provost on down was just a sham, and I have trouble with that.
Not suggesting that it was a sham, Your Honor, merely that it was
influenced. If we were to believe this professor's remark, we would have to think it was a sham.
Merely that the other levels of review were influenced by the initial review, which we believe was negatively impacted by discriminatory motive on the part of Professor Green and Professor Averbach. The Third Circuit in Roebuck versus Drexel University in 1988, dealing with university promotion decisions, said specifically that because promotion decisions are often made and approved by multiple individuals at multiple levels, discrimination may infect the decision at any stage, and the plaintiff need not prove intentional discrimination at any phase. Its impermissible bias at any point, says the Third Circuit, may be sufficient to sustain liability. The Ninth Circuit in 1999, in a case called Lamb versus University of Hawaii, quoted Roebuck and said essentially the same thing. It is permissible, said the Ninth Circuit, for the jury to consider and conclude that an evaluation based on discrimination early in the process infected the ultimate decision.
But you have to prove that. I mean, the problem is, long after Professor Green makes his remark, there are committee after committee that look at the record, and their reports indicate that they're not in any way influenced by what Professor Green said.
If we look at one of those committees, Judge, the Promotion and Tenure Committee of the Department of Materials Science and Engineering, During the time that Professor Green was a member of that committee, which was a 10-year span of time, including the time that Professor Soon was considered, they considered 19 separate cases
right,
of promotion.
I know, the numbers are very small, but if you want to see, actually, your time has just expired.
It has, Judge. Thank you very much. I stand on my brief, and I ask this Court to reverse the judgment of the District Court.
All right, thank you, Mr. Stevens. Mr. Kearns?
Your Honor, as you know, it's a 10-year case, and this Court has spoken many times on the deference that needs to be granted to the universities in making selections about tenure and into the departments. If the Court is going to follow those decisions, the Court is going to have to recognize that the Department of Materials Science and Engineering, one of the top two in the country, is the best judge of who is qualified for tenure within that department.
That's, of course, true, except that we've never said that the Department of Material Engineering would be entitled to say, you know, we're not going to have any women ever in the tenured faculty, or we're not going to have anybody else, you know, fill in the blank protected category.
I would certainly
hope not. We can't do that. I mean, that's illegal.
I would certainly hope not, Your Honor. And that's the next prong of the argument, has to be that they have to show that when the department makes its judgment, that judgment is a pretext for an improper and illicit motive, and they haven't even gotten anywhere near that. This is a case in which the department, and I think it's important to bear in mind as well, the promotion and tenure committee of this department is the department. It's 18 people. That was not the case except for the two last times. When Professor Weaver came to the university and became department head, he changed it from a committee of four, which Mr. Stevens referred to a committee of the whole. The only thing the Promotion and Tenure Committee did after that was to work up the dossier and set the schedule, basically, for the department considerations. After that, there were two separate all-department discussions of the case, and the plaintiff, in this case, got to make a presentation, a colloquium of what he had in the future. At the presentations, another member, in this case Professor Ballon, who was a supporter of Professor Soon, presented the case to the faculty as a whole, after which they had a discussion, and after that discussion, they voted.
But Professor Soon has argued that, to take the creation of the dossier, that there were taints even in that process with choosing who the outside evaluators would be and paying attention to his concerns that some of them might be predisposed against him. In other words, I mean, the process itself has to have integrity, right?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. And the process itself has been investigated ad nauseum and been found to be completely full of integrity. I'm glad that the court mentioned that, because Professor Soon claims that he had two unfavorable members of the people who were asked to write reports about him that were biased against him, Professor Mills and Professor Vessier. And if you read the dossier and read those letters, you'll be stunned. You wouldn't be able to say these guys are prejudiced against anybody. Professor Mills, just to give you one example of it, his letter finishes off as follows. In my opinion, Dr. Sun is clearly deserving of promotion to the rank of assistant professor. There's no bias here. It got investigated by the Faculty Advisory Committee, who I have some issues with, but certainly even they found that this was entirely proper. Professor Sun has got, as you detected there, he's got two theories. One is they're out to get me. Professor Weaver's out to get me. And then when he can't find any evidence of somebody being out to get him, he says, well, then that guy doesn't like me because he's a racist. There's no connection. There's no evidence whatsoever. There's no direct evidence. And if you look at the record, you'll see that there's no indirect evidence as well. And what I would like to take some time to do here, Your Honor, is to address some of the things that were in Mr. Stevens' reply brief in which he argued pretext, which I think are totally misrepresenting the record and which are unsubstantiated by the record. He made a big point of the fact, for example, that Professor Soon's funding was just the same as Professor Ballon's.
Well, he says you're not comparing like and like, you know, how many years and how much, which of these are multi-year grants and which are
However, if you look at Professor Balan's dossier and you look at Professor Sun's, you'll see that's just out of whole cloth. It's not true. Professor Balan, in the 5 years from the time he started, got $930,000 in funding. Professor Sun got $350,000. An extra year was added to get him up to the $460,000 that Professor Robertson came up with. Professor Robertson was the head of the department when the third vote on Professor Sun was taken, and he wrote an opinion, as he's required by Communication 9 to do, expressing the reasons why he didn't think Professor Sun was qualified for tenure. He mentioned the fact that in the 5 years he'd been there, he'd gotten two awards. He'd had 24 submissions with only two awards. If you look at the letters, there were five letters written by outside people. Several of them mentioned the fact that his funding was not good. This is not something that came up.
Professor Sun also, I guess it's probably the reply brief I'm thinking of, says some of the criteria on which you are relying, such as citation indexes, were never mentioned as a factor before. Is that true?
I'd like to address citation indexes, Your Honor, because the reason citation indexes came up was because when the College of Engineering Promotion and Tenure Committee was attempting to make a determination whether there had been any bias in the denial, they decided the best way to do that was be to compare Professor Sun with Professor Balan, the only other person. That's something that was never done before. That's when the citation index came up in the college committee trying to make some comparison of the value of the two of the publications. And they pointed out that Professor Balan's publications were cited a good deal more often. But I think you should also be aware that if you look at those evaluation letters that were submitted with the dossier from the outside people, that was a comment that was made by them as well. It wasn't just something that was made out of whole cloth by Professor Cooper. I don't suggest to you that every time somebody comes up for tenure, they get out the citation index and look at it. But what I'm saying is, when he's making a comparison between two people, that's a perfectly legitimate way to weigh the contributions that each of them is making. That's the point there. He also makes the point in his reply brief that graduate students are better for Professor Sun than they are for Professor Balan because he had seven. Professor Balan had only five. But he fails to state that Professor Balan was advancing his students. Professor Balan had one PhD and one up for candidate. Professor Sun had two that were no longer in the program and no PhD candidates. That was also discussed in the letters, not just by the College Promotion and Tenure Committee.
Well, look, in the final analysis, it seems to me what you have to do is somehow show that whatever bias Professor Green may have injected into the process at the outset didn't sort of turn into a virus, you know, and infect the rest of it along the way, because there's absolutely no doubt that not only case law, but those of us who are familiar with academic institutions, there's a subjective element of evaluating the quality of someone's work. You know, people read articles, they look at presentations, they look at funding, they look at the kind of teacher you are, they look at all kinds of factors and process them and decide who you want for tenure. And as far as it goes, without any indication that there's an impermissible factor going into that, as you began, that's a decision for universities. I mean, I think the question here is whether there is either anything retaliatory or anything impermissibly race-based about these evaluations at Illinois.
Well, Your Honor, as I'm sure you're aware, we went through this process twice just mm-hmm. to make sure that there was no impermissible bias. Joe Green made a comment that wasn't about Professor Sun in another meeting 6 months before the vote. He's one vote out of 18. Although they like to pretend like he's the kingmaker down there, the fact is he's got one vote out of 18 on the faculty, and he got to talk at the faculty meeting just like the other 17 people did. There's absolutely not a shred of evidence to suggest that he's biased, for that matter, but even if he were, that he was able to somehow infect the 18 people that voted in that meeting. When it went to the next level, nobody was even aware of that comment. They were looking at the overall dossier to see what it contained, and they were aware that there were challenges to Professor Weaver, And that's why they gave him another chance. When the second time came through, Professor Weaver wasn't even, he wasn't the chairman of the department. He didn't participate in the meeting, and they didn't count his vote.
That's when it's effectively a tie vote, right? That was the 9-9 with one abstention?
Well, it's a tie vote in the sense that 9-9 is a tie, but it's not a tie vote in the sense that if he'd been 10-8 in favor, he would have gotten tenure. As Mr. Stevens correctly pointed out, one or two people against tenure is something that has to be explained, and if it's 10-8, it's just not going to happen. This is the best department in the country, and they have to have the right to make that kind of a judgment, which they do routinely. The last thing I would point out is, after all this, after they got a new department head, after they didn't let the old department head vote, after they voted against him, after the new department head recommended against it for reasons which were cited completely in Judge McCuskey's ruling, which are very compelling if you read them, he got yet another chance. They brought in the ad hoc committee, and they let them evaluate it. Now,
and who? These were senior people from related areas?
In the engineering department,
yes, engineering department.
Right. There's, as you know, the any tenure candidate is reviewed at the department, college, and campus level.
Right.
And these were gentlemen that had routinely reviewed cases at the campus level. The campus level always has the executive officer's comments, Professor Robertson's comments. It's interesting that one of the points that Mr. Stevens makes in his argument is we didn't offer any reasons why he was denied tenure. And he complains about the ad hoc committee not being fair because they were given reasons why he was denied tenure. And as if these people aren't able to review the reasoning of Professor Robertson and make a comment on it. That's what they do. That's their job. There's simply no basis for that whatsoever, for that comment. The other thing I would comment just in passing, I see I'm getting close to my time being up, I haven't got much more to say either, is that the idea that this is a racist decision is absolutely unsubstantiated. He came up with all those votes, but the suggestion or the implication is that on all those votes where the white guy got a positive recommendation, it was a competition. Each one of these is on its own. The fact that one person gets tenure, there's no limitation on the number of tenured professors. The fact that Professor Green got tenure or Professor Averback got tenure has no bearing whatsoever on whether Professor Shang gets tenure or whether Professor Soon gets tenure. The only two that were voted by the committee as a whole were Professor Ballone and Professor Soon, but that's not true anymore because there have been more votes, and that came in the record as well. There have been two Chinese who have been given tenure since that time by the new system that was set up by Professor Weaver. In short, there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that this was pretextual, and to cut to the chase, as this court has said on more than one occasion, if they haven't got evidence of pretext, then they're doomed to fail. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens. Mr. Stevens, had any time? Your time has expired, but you may have a minute, Mr. Stevens.
Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate that. First, I would point out that the magistrate, Judge Bernthal, did, in fact, in his second order, state that default would be entered if the ruling was not followed, and it was not followed. I would point this court to EEOC versus Target Corporation, a Seventh Circuit case from 2006. That deals with this issue of pretext. It has to do with the second prong of McDonnell-Douglas, that is where the defendant has to articulate a non-discriminatory reason for the decision. This court said in Target that the employer must explain the reason clearly enough to allow the plaintiff to find the kind of evidence to present pretext. Target did not, and therefore they were not entitled to summary judgment. In this case, the university did not either. All they said was, over and over and over again, and this is in their papers regarding summary judgment, Professor Soon did not meet the standards. They were asked, what standards didn't he meet? They did not say. They just said again, he did not meet the standards. Under EEOC versus Target, they are not entitled to summary judgment without making that kind of articulated statement. I'd ask this court to reverse the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kearns. Case is taken under advisement.